So hundreds and thousands of Vietnamese ran, including my family, my mother and my two younger sisters and myself. Because we were told, we heard the rumors that was that we were going to be killed by the communists because our family had affiliations with the United States of America.
So how do you determine what success looks like to you? Do you base it on the results and outcomes or on what you've learned along the way? You see, society has conditioned us to tie success to an outcome. But the truth is, failure is an essential part of success. The faster you fail, the faster you will succeed. So the real question is, how can we redefine our relationship with not just failure, but with success as well? Join us to find the answers that will allow you to live a life that's true to yourself and find the clarity you need to make that life a reality. I'm your host, King Lau, and you're listening to the Plan to Fail podcast. What's going on, everybody? It's your boy King here, and welcome back to the Plan to Fail podcast. Storytelling is honestly one of the most important aspects in our communications, no matter if it's in business or in life. If you take a moment and think about it, we resonate the most with stories, especially stories of watching or seeing someone go through a certain level of struggle to achieve what they want to achieve. And there's a reason why stories resonate so much with us. And that reason is because we are emotional creatures. And at the end of the day, if you like it or not, we make all of our decisions based on our emotions. And stories is the best way for us to tap into the emotions or tap into other people's emotions. And that's why knowing and learning how to properly tell stories is such a crucial skill to have now, especially if you're in business. If you think about it, in business, a lot of the times people or businesses try and stand out by doing it bigger and better, or maybe doing it the cheapest, right? The most economical way. You have your luxury brands like the LVs and the Guccis that go for premium quality and that brand name. And you also have companies like, I don't know, Gap or Winners that go for the economical route. So a lot of the times that's how businesses operate. But if you really want to truly stand out in the marketplace, then you're going to have to master the art of storytelling, especially telling your own story. And why I'm saying this is because today I want to share with you an interview I did with Dai Li for the BYOB Summit. And in this interview with Dai, we talked about her story and her journey coming from Vietnam to going to Australia as a refugee and eventually working in journalism and becoming a politician. And throughout her life, she has really seen the value of telling stories, and to the point that she started a company called Dawn Media Productions that focuses on telling the stories of untold stories of unsung heroes. So the interview I did with Dai is mainly based on her story. So I really want you to focus on her story and the different aspects that she focuses on and see how you can relate that to your story so that you can be a better storyteller when it comes to your story. Because at the end of the day, if you want to convince people to do business with you, the most important aspect is for you to share your story in the most authentic way possible. And it's harder than it seems. So I really hope you find value in what Dai had to share in the interview I did with her. And I know that if you know, you really dig deep, you'll be able to find different ways to tell your story as well. So without further ado, let's jump right into it. So what's your unique story? I think more importantly, do you see the significance of your story? Do you understand how important your story is to you? Because your story is uniquely yours. And your story is what inspires other people. You might not be able to see it right now, but we humans, we thrive off stories. Stories is what inspires us to take action. And while you might not think much about your story, let me tell you right now that your story is going to inspire somebody out there. It's not going to inspire everybody, but there is somebody out there that needs to hear your story. So you better start embracing your story and share it with the world, because the world needs to hear your story. So are you ready to level up? Let's go.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Be Your Own Boss Summit, or BYOB for short, where I'm asking expert entrepreneurs from various backgrounds about what it takes for you to become the boss of your business and not let your business become the boss of you. I'm here today with the amazing Dai Li. Dai founded Dawn, a social enterprise of professional thought leaders whose mission is to encourage humanity, collaboration, and inclusiveness in the workplace and business. Dawn's vision is to shine the light on unheard stories of unsung heroes, amplifying courageous conversations. Born in Saigon, Vietnam, Dai spent many years in refugee camps in Southeast Asia before being accepted for resettlement in Australia. Her childhood experiences and growing up with the dual identity being Vietnamese in Australia and Western culture surrounding her helped her shape her perception of life. It has also made her a passionate advocate for refugees and migrant communities. With a group of women from migrant and refugee backgrounds, Dai recently formed the Dawn Media Productions Limited, whose vision is to impact the world with one courageous conversation at a time. DMP's mission is to amplify the untold stories of unseen faces and unheard voices to help change makers, business owners, and thought disruptors tell their story and brand with passion, credibility, and authenticity in 1 minute bite-sized video snippets. Dai, I really want to thank you for taking the time and being on the summit. Just after even learning about your story, it's been such an inspiration to see how you progressed and tackled each challenge of life. And in turn, instead of turning away from your story, you used your story to help so many other people understand the importance of connection through stories. So I really want to just thank you for taking the time and just being on the summit and really sharing your story with us, because like during my journey, storytelling has been so important, but too often than not, we just feel this shame of the things we go through. So we tend to just hide and shy away from it. So you're honestly such an inspiration. I'm just putting yourself out there.
Thank you, King. Thank you so much. And I just want to congratulate you for organizing BYOB?
Yeah, BYOB.
Yeah. Bring your own business. absolutely. It's great. And yes, I think at the heart of human beings is the ability to talk to one another, to communicate. And I think to do that effectively and powerfully, I think it's through storytelling. People have to share their stories in order for our, because our brain is wired to actually remember stories better than say facts or figures and stuff like that. So if you tell a story, it's able to retain that information. Yeah. And also it can connect us as to one another, you know, our differences, no matter where we are, from what cultural backgrounds we're from, but to actually listen to a story, you feel, you know, you get connected to that emotionally and I think mentally as well.
Yeah, I think it's so important, especially the emotional aspect. We forget that we are, at the end of the day, we're all emotional creatures. And I think that it's just so great that what you share actually is, it's not just the highlights, but you share your struggles. And I feel like that really brings the human connection, because too often than not, and I'm the first to admit that, you know, you fall in the trap where like, oh, this problem is unique to me. And I don't want to share it because sometimes you feel ashamed of it, even though there's no reason to feel ashamed to it. So I think you putting yourself out there is actually such an amazing inspiration just for people to feel more comfortable. I think even the first time after having the chance to chat with you, I really felt more comfortable even, you know, being more confident in sharing my story as well. So just for our audience, I would love to kind of go back to like just a little bit of a background for our audience to understand where you're coming from, because I know that you are a lady that wears many hats, from a journalist to now entrepreneur and also politics as well. So can you actually, I guess, like kind of bring us back to like where you started, I guess, from Vietnam, your time in Vietnam to Australia, to Hong Kong, to Australia. So yeah, like just give us some background first. That'd be great.
Yeah, actually I was writing, cause I'm in the process of writing a book. So, my editor, my manuscript editor is waiting for my you know, next version. So it's detailing the journey of my life. And I was just reading it this morning. I'm thinking, oh my God. So I came to Australia as a refugee from Vietnam. So, you know, I don't know if your audience remember or will remember the war in Vietnam. And I don't know if you were taught at school the war in Vietnam. So that's that happened. The war ended in, should have ended in 72, but for the Vietnamese living there, we finally heard that the communists were moving from the north down to the south in April 75. So that's the time when my family escaped. So there were, if you remember, some of those vision that you probably watch on war documentaries, is when the helicopter landing on that presidential palace in Vietnam. That's around the time that we ran as well. So hundreds and thousands of Vietnamese ran, including my family, my mother, and my two younger sisters, and myself. Because we were told, we heard the rumors that was that we were going to be killed by the communists because our family had affiliations with the United States of America. Because my father was working for the U.S. Embassy. So in what capacity, I've got no clue. I was a very young child. And he then, in addition, he disappeared during that period when we were running. So it was my mother and my two younger sisters. So there were three of us, plus back then in Vietnam, we had a maid who we later called our auntie. So she came along with us. She was caring for my younger sister. And so that boat trip took us, first of all, to the Philippines. So we were in what we call displaced people camps in the Philippines. And we were waiting for our father to come, you know, and we were told that all the men will be joining their families in the Philippines, and then we'll be then relocated to the US because of my father's connection to the US. We waited for a few years. You know, I was a kid. Of course, you weren't really tuned to what was going on. The discussions among the adults in these displaced people camps where we were housed. And then I think maybe 2 years later, my mother decided to then pack her one suitcase that she took from Vietnam on that boat, and took the three of us. This time my auntie did not join us. We didn't know why, because we just followed my mother. And we followed my mother to a beach, and on that beach there were other Vietnamese refugees from the various camps in the Philippines back in those days. And that night we then were ushered into a small boat on a beach somewhere in the Philippines, got no idea where. There were about 35 of us together, and on that boat we then set sail again. As you can imagine, I was 10 by that stage. I had no idea what was going on. Of course, being the daughter of within an Asian culture, as a child, you don't question your parents, you don't ask questions, you don't say anything. You really don't exist other than in physicalness. So followed and got into that boat. And I don't know how long we were on that boat, but it felt like eternity. We encountered storms, encountered a reef, encountered pirates. So there were three incidents on that boat trip that could have killed us, but didn't. And then we finally got to Hong Kong camps. I don't know where my mother thought she would go on that small boat with this group of people, but we got pulled into Hong Kong camps. Where we stayed for another nearly 9 months or something like that. So we went from various camps in Hong Kong. So from the age of 7 to the age of 10, I was moving in from one camp to the next camp, had no proper education. So we finally got accepted to go to the US. So we were so excited. We were going to go. I was excited because, you know, we were living in refugee camps. And if you've seen any of the documentaries, again, on camps, refugee camps, refugees were living on top of one another. sharing, you know, in warehouses, like thousands of people cramming into a small space.
Right.
So I, at the age of 10, I was working in a factory in Hong Kong because they, you know, faked my age and, you know, I was supposed to be 16. And back in those days, Hong Kong, you know, were, you know, obviously child labor was not, it was okay. Like it wasn't an issue. So our, for me, it was trying to earn some money in order for us thinking when we get resettled in the US, right, we'll have some money, right?
Right, right.
So I was coming home one day from work. My mother stopped me at the gate. She goes, oh, look, we were accepted to go to the US, but I decided we're not going to go there. And of course, as a 10-year-old, you know, I'm like, what can, who am I to say, why didn't you take, accept and let me go, us go, right? I just said, okay, mum, right? She said, oh, but I actually applied to go to another country. It's an island, actually, she said. It's a place called Ukdailoi, which means Australia. Never heard of the place before in my life. It was an island. So in my mind, an island, I just imagined this green island in the middle of the ocean. And she said, but it had the best education system in the world.
Right.
So, yes, that was my mother's decision. And soon after, a few months later, we were accepted to be resettled in Australia. Right. So that was, for me, oh my God, I was so excited that we finally left, you know, we're leaving this camp. So crowded, and it was so, I mean, look, as a 10-year-old, it was just the fact that, you know, I couldn't go to school. I don't think I was impacted in the sense that, oh, this is all, you know, terrible. It's just like, oh, I'd like to go to school. And I, you know, I was living here. It's just, there was no uncertainty. This is not your home, and your home was a double bunk bed, for instance. So it's not so much the environment. It's just, I wanted to go to school. So I thought, oh, if I was to resettle, it'd be great to go to school. And so the fact that we got to resettle in Australia, where it had the best education system in the world, I was so excited, looking to restart that life, you know, to go to school again. So yeah, so we came to Australia, one suitcase, not a word of English, excited that we're landing in this new island that had the best education system in the world. So, you know, and was thinking what that would be like.
Yeah, no, I think this is like, you know, as much as I did my homework, I tried my best to put it together. I think it's so different just hearing and describing each of the, how life was. And I think your story is so unique, and I'm sure that, you know, like certain moments, and having to kind of flee from the war and then being in a camp for so many years, like it really, especially as a child, it really shapes you. Because I think, like, even for me, like a lot of people, like your first few years, it really shapes the way you view the world. So I'm actually very curious, like, are there certain moments or memories from that period in your life that really still influences your worldview today? Because I'm confident for sure, like you have more empathy towards refugees than a lot of other people are. Not saying that they don't care or they don't have the heart to, but until you've been in those shoes, like, you can never fully understand what they're going through, because I have friends who care. But at the same time, it's just like, until you've been in those shoes, like, you can never truly feel the pain and the suffering and how much hardship they're going through.
Absolutely. I think the first escape when Saigon fell, I remember standing on the boat and looking out and remember the memory of that my birth country was going to explode. Because, you know, you know, in your mind, your child's mind, like, this is, you're running because this place is going to kind of go up in flame. So that's, you know, in your mind's child's mind, you think, oh my God, I'll never see my birthplace again. I used to climb trees a lot, and I thought I'll never be able to climb trees again. I love climbing trees, and that freedom to run around. It just took it out of it, you know, you felt like you just were taken out of it, and everything that you had or that you knew was just going to go disappear. Right. And I looked back and I thought, I will never see my birth country again.
Wow.
And I thought, where will I be? At that moment, on standing on that boat, I lost my mother for about a second or a few seconds because it was, we were escaping. There were hundreds of people. And I thought for a moment there, I thought I was alone, right? So I thought I was alone, and that means I'm going to be on my own now for the rest of my life. And funnily enough, I learned years on, later on in life, that a decision that you make as a child, a thought that you kind of planted, it actually flows into your being until you get to the point where you realize, oh my God, I made a decision when I was seven. I didn't even realize it. And I left, and I led a very independent life. And I led a very independent life to the point that I love, like I said, you know, like you're right. I felt like I need to help people because I had nobody helping me standing on that boat to comfort me, to tell me what's going on, to tell me, look, it's going to be okay. Nobody told me as a seven-year-old that was going to be okay. And so all my life, I created this, I'm on my own unconsciously, and therefore I was very independent. And all I did was basically, if I could help somebody, I will help them. I would help them with all of my heart. And sometimes you help the wrong people and he'll take advantage of you. But the idea of helping never stopped. Like, it doesn't matter if they burned you. It doesn't matter if you got burned. It's somehow innate in me to help. So that was one decision I made. And then once I got to Australia, that was years later, 10, the other decision I made was that I needed to learn English, because otherwise, if I did not know how to speak English well, I would not succeed in the society. Mm. And I made that decision unconsciously. I want to learn English so that I can integrate well. I want to be a new Australian. Because when we first arrived, we were the first influx of Vietnamese refugees. Australia wasn't a multicultural society that it is today. Right. In the 70s, Australia had just come out of the white Australia policy, which meant the majority of the populations were white, Anglo, or European as well. The Europeans were given a hard time because of their accent, you know, they were called wogs and all that stuff, but they still blended in because they looked the same. Whereas Asians, my God, we stood out like a sore thumb, black, you know, black eyes and dark skin and or yellow skin, we were called. So I felt that I had to really embrace Australia. I'm going to be the new Australian. I'm going to learn English, and that there was no need for me to learn Vietnamese. Right. And I did not learn Vietnamese, which I think looking back, you know, it's a mistake. I can speak it because we spoke at home. I can't read it. Even my Vietnamese now is just very like conversational. We're not fluent, right? Those two decisions meant that I believe I integrated well. So white Australians don't see me as a threat because I sounded like them, I behaved like them. So the other thing is that I said, I'm going to be a new Australian, which meant that I need to not think so much about doing the traditional Vietnamese things, right? When I go out. However, that said, at home, I was still very obedient. I still, you know, did not reply back to my mother. I still get disciplined. Back in those days, you know, there's a stick whereby you get disciplined if you were to debate. There's no such thing as debate. You can't debate your parents. I don't know if you experienced that.
Yeah, when you're younger.
My son now, he's 17 and a half. My God, he'll be retaliating. He would say, Mom, no, I'm not going to do that. Mother, I could never do that. My mother said something. If my mother said jump off the cliff, I would jump. So there's no way. My son would say, why would I do that? Why would I? Right? So kids raised in a Western society have the ability to question. I could not question. I could not be critical in terms of thinking. Everything was yes, Mom. Yes, yes, yes. So, yeah.
Wow, I think the first thought is like, it's just so, it's how cool, it's not just cool, but it's just awesome how like, you mean like a lot of, like you suffered a lot of traumas, like growing up, and you mean like just losing your home, losing your mom for a second, and even having that thought as a 7-year-old to like, you mean thinking that you're never going to see like your birth country again, and I feel like it's actually so awesome how you're able to come out so positive. You know, you want to help people because it's that fine line that it could have gone either way. And it really depends on who, like what you decided in that moment to take it. And so I know that like, this is kind of going a little bit off script of where I was wanting to take the question, but I feel like this is the right way for our audience to really see, like, you know what I mean, like when you do see something, because something that I've really learned the last year, couple of years, it's like your perception is your reality. And I mean, in the same circumstances, two people can perceive it in completely different ways. Maybe in a different alternate universe, right? If you decided to go a different route and be like, you know, like the U.S. they're taking over, and you know what I mean, like they're taking everything away from me, and like why would I ever help someone? The world's cruel. I'm losing everything. So what actually dictated your decision to, you know, instead of focusing on the negatives and being like, what's being taken away from me? Like, instead, I'm like, wow, nobody was there to help me. So I want to do the best of my ability as a human being to help whoever I can.
Yeah, look, you know what? I've asked myself that question over the years. I don't know why I'm more of a positive person. I mean, my sisters, for instance, my two younger sisters are different to me. They are more, I think, more Asian still in the terms of the fatalistic kind of approach. Oh, look, you know, this thing's so bad and there's nothing you can do about it. Whereas I don't come from that perspective. Mm. I come from the perspective that what can I do? What can I do to make things better for people, right? Yeah. And I think because of what I've been through, I want to make sure that it doesn't happen to others. You know, so even though I learned English, you know, you still have an accent. You know, my accent, my Asian accent really kind of diminished a bit when I became a journalist and a storyteller, because you had to train you as a broadcaster in this at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which is similar to the American Broadcasting Corporation, is a government, a corporate entity. Government funded, it's like the NPR, right? In the US. So the ABC, I was the first Asian face broadcaster that they had. Yeah. And so therefore I had to train to ensure that I my accent is, they didn't say it that way, but it's just, I had to ensure that I had right projection, right pronunciation and all that stuff. So learning that, even though I learned English growing up, even though I could speak it fluently, I knew that there were still moments during that journey in my career whereby I got discriminated by the system because I wasn't looking and sounding like an Aussie, an Australian.
Right.
And I thought, you know what, and I'm not somebody who sat back and said, oh, this is terrible, it's happened to me, I'm upset about it. I thought, okay, so how can I better myself and make sure that I integrate well. In addition, how to ensure that others after me can be trained so that they can actually do better than me, right? So I don't know. Is that a genetics thing? No, I don't think so, because my sisters like to help people, but they're a bit more negative, that type of things. Oh God, if they listen to this, then say, well, I'm not negative. What are you talking about?
That's the first sign.
Yeah, I know. But I wonder whether or not it's I wired my own brain, so to speak. I'm always curious. Even when I was young, I was always exploring. I was always climbing trees. My sisters don't climb trees. Well, the youngest one was too young to climb, but my second one was very quiet, you know, reserved. But I'm more out there looking, oh my God, what's going to happen? You know, I've fallen off trees. I've played like a tomboy. I'm out there trying to see what's going to happen, right? So maybe that was just me, what I was like really as a person. So I that said though, of course there are moments when you feel depressed.
Of course.
Right? You know, there are moments you think, really? Yes, there are moments when I've sat and cried on my own. You know, you bawl my eyes out because I'm thinking, oh my God, this is so difficult, it's so hard. Who can I turn to ask for advice, to ask for guidance? And you know what? I couldn't ask my mother because she couldn't speak English. She didn't understand the Western system. I really had no one, and I had no father. I had no one. Right. So I can cry, but then I have to pick myself up and thinking, probably go back to my 7-year-old and said, you're on your own now. You have to make sure that you've got to learn, make sure that you have to improve yourself, make sure you get on your feet again, cry your heart out, but then stand up and walk again. So, that's what I did.
Wow. Why I'm so curious, why I decided to kind of go that direction and ask the question is because it's something that I really admire of you, because like for me, I'll be the first to admit, in the first years, like I've had that victim mentality, there's nothing I can do. And that's why I had so much anxiety growing up. And I feel like even my high school counselors used to say like, wow, this kid guy is just full of anxiety. And it always felt like, there's nothing I could do to help it. And just kind of seeing how you had a much harder childhood than I have, I'll be the first to admit that. And just seeing how you've been able to carry that, it's been just really inspiring. And I think that I know that there are people out in our audience, right, that do struggle with it, because at the end of the day, it's such a mindset. It was so hard for me to snap out and take full responsibility, because something I've really learned over the years is like, even though you might not have control of what happens to you, but at the same time, you are in complete control of how you react and what you're going to take that circumstance, which direction you're going to go. But like, you know what I mean, it's just kind of seeing like, you know, right, like with your past and like after like you're graduating with a major in political science, like what really got you to go into journalism? Like, did you always see it as like a platform for you to tell stories of other people, or was it something you developed along the way?
You know, when people ask me, how did you get into journalism? How did you get into politics? I say, I've said to them, I've stumbled into journalism and I stumbled into politics. I really stumbled into journalism because a lot of, I don't know whether or not, I'm sure your audience, if they're of Asian heritage in particular, is that your parents or ethnic or diverse, you know, culturally, linguistically diverse backgrounds, is that their parents expect you to be either a lawyer, a doctor, a pharmacist, an accountant, right?
Yeah.
So the one thing I know is that my father was a lawyer. Right. And so there was this expectation that I should become a lawyer. Mm. So I was terrible at school. I was not academically gifted. I was really good in the arts, painting-wise. But I had to stop that because that wasn't a career. So I had to focus on maths, which I was terrible at, and subjects such as physics and chemistry, which I was terrible at. But anyway, I focused on that subjects to give me the marks to go and do law. And I went into law a few months. I sat through the lecture theatre up for a few, 3 months. And I came from a dysfunctional family because my mother is a single mum.
Right.
Of course, we now describe her condition as post-traumatic disorder in the sense that, you know, she came here with nobody, no one at all, and had to raise her 3 daughters on her own. I don't think she knew how to raise the 3 of us, because if we were in Vietnam, there would be a community to raise the children, whereas in Australia or in a Western society, you're on your own. It's an individualistic society. It's not a communal society.
Right.
So growing up in that single family household, mum couldn't speak English. She was a domestic worker. We had to, you know, during growing up, I had to go and help her clean houses so for her to earn money. So back in those days, not like today, there weren't any government handouts. There were no government money. So you actually have to work to earn the income to support your family, which I think is a great thing, right? And that's what made people independent and self-reliant rather than reliant on the government. That also makes you more innovative of thinking. You're more resourceful. You have to think of ways to survive, right? But in Australia, unlike the US, we have a much more stronger safety net for the newly arrived. In terms of in the last decade, But when we arrived, there was nothing. So mum had to work in, you know, cleaning toilets, cleaning homes, kitchen hand. I was all being the eldest, also went out to work to help while I was going to school.
Right.
Thank God I was going to school, right? Because I was happy I was going to school, but I knew that I also had to earn some money to help, you know, help my mother.
Right.
So, but growing up, that single parent household also gave, I think why younger people, yet generation in this day and age, find it very difficult to adapt or when they face with adversity, they think, oh my God, how I'm going to deal with this? How I'm going to survive this? Is because you've got a safe environment. You've got a nurturing environment, be it your family, be it your friends. So everything is there. So when something really dramatic happens, you think, oh my God, that's the end of the world. And suddenly, okay, that's a first world problem, right? And that's why when something that, when a teacher gets scream at you, suddenly you think, oh my God, you know, I've been victimized, you know, that teacher's picking on me. When, sure, there could be, but then if you are actually have a strong constitution, you might think, right. Oh, well, look, that's okay. That teacher doesn't know how to communicate with me effectively. That's all right. I'll let that teacher go and kind of focus on what I have to focus on. Just an example, for instance. Sometimes my son comes home and he will complain about the teacher. And I said, well, darling, you know what? You've got a teacher. You've got a classroom to go to. You've got an opportunity to learn. I said, up until the age of 11, I actually had no proper education. So when I got into school and got to sit in a classroom, I appreciate everything. I appreciate even the teacher was screaming at me. But I was too good. You know, because I was raised not to debate or ask questions. I was the best student, or people like refugees like myself were very good students in class with teachers because we don't ask questions. We sat there, we listened, right? Whereas my son, who was born in this day and age, will question the teacher. You know, will say no. And that's for me, oh, my God, you're questioning the teacher, and then he'll come home and he'll complain about it. So the upbringing and the environment really shapes you as a person. I'm gone and long-winded here, but hopefully
I love it. I'm sorry. I think it's so powerful because it's like, you know, you're such a great storyteller that each question you end up just telling the story. And I think
stories.
it's good. I think it's like, you know, sometimes it's like some of these topics, like even for storytelling, like as much as I want to have the questions, I think this is where I embrace with the flow, because it's the best way to teach storytelling is by storytelling. And I think that it's so true where your environment really shapes. I think this is why, like, a lot of the times, I would say people in like my generation, it's like the first generation where they didn't have to survive. They don't have to fight for anything. So everybody's just kind of like sitting around and like, okay, what do I do? So like, even for me putting this together is like, I think my mission is really to help people take back control of their life. And I think that it was something that it was so life changing for me when I finally took responsibility for everything that happened to me. When I finally took responsibility that, no matter if it's anybody else's fault, it's always my responsibility. And it's not to blame me. Yeah.
It starts with you, right? I believe that's my personal philosophy. The difference is you. It starts with you. Mm-hmm. And really, at the end of the day, you have to take responsibility for your life. Yeah. In some situations, if you are suffering from mental health, mental illness, then maybe your ability to be able to understand how much responsibility you have for your own life could be impacted. But for the majority of people that are healthy, that are physically well and that are mentally well, when we feel sorry for ourselves, sometimes you have to stop and think, well, you know, you're an adult or you're a young adult, and you've had and I think appreciating how privileged we are. So I take my son growing up, I used to take him you know, when I go to Vietnam, because I still go and visit my grandmother in Vietnam. Mm. She still lives in a village. So we built her a house. She used to live in a mud house, but we built her a house. But even though the house in the country, in the province where she lives, it's still very, very kind of base, actually more than, it's not even basic. It's really, you know, tap water is just not like we have in Western society. So I take my son to these places and he sees the poverty, right? Mm. He sees that his great-grandmother, I remember, I think he was in year 7 or year 8, I took him I've took him to Vietnam a few times. I took him to Fiji a few times. Mm. But every time when we go to a location, I take him to an area whereby he's exposed to the living conditions of young people his age, right, in a developing country. So in one instance, when we went to Fiji, we were in a resort, but we went for a walk down this beautiful place. And as we walked past, there were all of these shacks where young kids were living, like families were living, right? And these kids were not in class. So they were really, their clothes were ripped and everything. And he walked and he looked and he looked, he goes, "Oh, Mom, that kid is not at school." I said, "No, of course, not every kid's go to school." Mm. And he goes, "Look at his clothes." And, you know, I said, "Well, you know, there are some shorts that you've got that you're not wearing. Do you think we should give those shorts to the kids?" He goes, "Yeah, okay." So we went back to the hotel and then packed his clothes. He goes, "Look, I've got more clothes at home. Let's pack this and give this to this child."
Wow.
So we went back to this place and I said to him, "You need to give it to that child," right? So he went and gave it to that child. And then we went to my grandmother's village. He went back there and he saw the toilet and the water system. Like, it's so primitive. And I remember when he came back home, back to Sydney, he just focused on studying. And from that, I think it was year 7, year 8, from that moment on, he changed his attitude towards his studies. And there was a change in him. And my husband and I said, "You know what? We've exposed him a lot often, but that was when he was younger. But I think with year 7, year 8, I think he was a bit more mature and he saw poverty differently." And so I think if you see how privileged you are and where you're living, what you've got, and you then actually have a different perspective to life, and that you don't take anything for granted.
For sure. And I think that's why it's so important to experience. And you experience and just to tie it back to storytelling, that's why it's so important to share experiences, because that's what really moves people. At the end of the day, I think something that we both brought up is we're all emotional creatures. That's what drives us, inspires us to move forward. Even for the summit, it's like what we've really focused on was like a mix of story and tactical tips, because stories is what inspires people to actually take action. So with storytelling, especially when, you know, like you said earlier, you stumbled into journalism, you stumbled into politics. So like, I guess during that process, like, how did you start seeing the power of storytelling? Because that's when you started, I mean, going out there and like, and telling the stories. Sorry.
Yeah, I digress a bit, isn't it? When I said I stumbled to journalism, I went from law and I couldn't get finished law, left law.
Yeah.
And then I applied and then I was waitressing for about 12 months. And then one day I was sitting having a coffee, which my sister organized, with this guy who was a journalist.
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, look," he said, "What are you doing now?" I said, "Oh, I don't know. I'm just waitressing. I've got no idea what I'm going to do with my life." And he goes, "Oh, have you thought about journalism?" And I said, "Oh, what is journalism?" He said, "It's about telling stories, going to interview people and getting their stories and writing it." He said, "You've been telling me your story here and it's fascinating. And I think you can get those stories from people." I said, "Oh, okay." And he goes, there's a job going at the local paper. Why don't you apply for it as a cadetship? And I think you'll get it. I said, okay. So I applied for it and I got the job the next week and I started. And I remember the editor said to me, "Do you know how to write stories? Do you know how to write?" I said, "Oh, yes, I can write." And I sent him a few essays, you know, that you write from friggin' university. He goes to me, he read, he goes, "Well, this is not storytelling, but it's you can write. So I'm sure we can teach you how to, you know, report. And so that, so then my journey into journalism began. So they sent me out to then, so that role was, is called ethnic reporter. Ethnic means it's to go out there and interview people of ethnic background, right? So because they said there were no other ethnic reporters back in those days in the press, in the mainstream media in Australia. And they said because where we were, where I was growing up in Fairfield, it was very culturally diverse. There were a lot of migrants and refugees being resettled and they wanted to get their stories. So they said I would be the best person to go out there and interview them. So I did. So I went out and I started interviewing people and it was amazing. And that's when I started to say, oh, my God, listening to people's stories was just amazing. Their journeys, what they experienced, how it impacted them emotionally. And then you're able to craft and write those stories in a way that opened the eyes for me back in those days of the wider Australian society, because the wider Australian society had no idea about the experiences and the lives and the journeys of people of migrant and refugee backgrounds. Because while we were culturally diverse, we weren't cohesive in a sense that we weren't engaged with one another. We weren't trying to understand one another. So we were living in each other's, in our little, you know, ghetto is not the word, but in our communities, there was no engagement. And so what I found the power of storytelling was that I can interview anyone even from a prostitute to a banker to a member of parliament, and all of their stories were able to shine a light on how we live as, you know, human beings in a society. So you got to know one another, and I saw the power of that, and I just really thrived in that environment. And I think, I don't know if your grandparents or parents used to tell you stories or not, but I'm sure they do. You know, they used to read books to you, like I used to read books to my son. And my grandmother used to tell me stories, like there were no books back in those days when I was growing up, but she used to tell me stories about the pineapple, how the pineapple got eyes, for instance, right? So if you think about it, we grew up hearing stories. We all do. But we never thought about how important it is to make it part of our living in this day and age. And I think we're going back to stories now. We're going back to, it's not about marketing, it's not about PR anymore. It's about understanding one another's story so that we can actually connect with one another better and reach out to one another and also collaborate with one another. So I think stories is now becoming more important in people's lives.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's something that it's something that even I'm learning over time, because like, I think last time in our last conversation, I thought that I could hide behind the brand. I wouldn't have to tell my story. And I think that this is why it's important, because even it's kind of fun, even between the last conversation we had and now, I had somebody I knew in the past that reached out and like, wow, like, you know, like your podcast that I've been putting up has really shifted my perspective. And I remember that was like, one of those, like, I guess, paradigm shifts in your head, where I knew that there were people listening behind the scenes, but I've never gotten direct feedback. And I think even that experience has been like me sharing myself, because I put myself out there in there. I think when I did the podcast, even though it was so hard for me to do, it's one of the things I told myself was, I'm just going to be authentically me. I'm literally using this. If nobody listens or if nobody resonates with it, I'm just seeing it as me documenting my journey. So one day when I look back at it, and just having someone reach out and be like, you know, what you're sharing, you know what I mean, has really shifted my perspective. Just makes me understand it so much more.
And I think the power of storytelling is in being able to be vulnerable, because as you said, is when you open up, it's when you share your personal experience and journey, you realize that you're not on your own. You know, you realize you're able to help somebody who's been down a similar path. You know, in a world of 7 billion people, we are bound to find a tribe in a community who would share and who would experience and who would actually relate to what we've been through. And so it's so important to be able to be vulnerable and to talk about that, and not to be fearful, not to be scared about being judged, because especially of a cultural heritage, Asian heritage, we're always about keeping face, right? We're always about, oh, let's not say something because it's going to bring shame to our family.
Yes.
Or let's not talk about it because it's so embarrassing. Oh my God, let's not talk about it because, oh God, maybe I'm, you know, this is going to be only me. Nobody else is going to happen. And who's going to want to hear my story anyway? Like, right. I don't want to talk about it. But you know what? There are people out there who want to know, who want help, who want to listen to somebody who's been through a similar experience. I mean, for example, my cancer journey. Having cancer is a taboo subject. Within the Asian and ethnic communities, people don't talk about having breast cancer or having any cancer because it's a shame thing, is somehow. And I wanted to change that. And so I talked about my cancer experience when I got diagnosed, when I lost my hair, and when the hair started to grow back. I didn't wear a scarf. I just let my bald head, with about that, you know, I went to events. And I think women, especially Asian women, thinking, oh, my God, she's got no hair and she's going out there like that.
Awesome.
And it's about embracing you no matter what. Because if you don't embrace yourself, who is going to embrace you?
Right.
Who's going to embrace you if you don't embrace yourself? So you're going to be comfortable in your own skin. I think the world is out there to be able to, I think, face the world. You got to be able to face yourself first. You got to be able to be comfortable in your own skin and embrace and accept you for who you are. And then you go out there and you face the world.
Yeah, I think it's so important because, like, at the end of the day, like, with 7 billion people, how do you stand out? Everybody's always trying to find the next innovative thing, but your story will be uniquely yours. I think then that's the best way you can stand out. And people spend all this time like, I'm going to create a product or a service that is different. Like, if you thought about it, somebody's probably thought about it and done it too. If you really want to stand out, you got to embrace yourself. And if you cannot love yourself, then how can you expect other people to accept you if you can't accept yourself? But like, it's like, just kind of moving along. I know you just brought up your cancer, your story, and you're being very open in it. And that shifted a lot of perspectives on, you know, where your life was, because that was such a shock to your life. And around that time when you had your battle with your health, that's when you set up Dawn, like a network focused on businesses and leaders who are making social impact through inclusion and diversity. So what actually sparked the birth of this organization, and what was your original vision for Dawn for the first few years? Like, what kind of impact did you think you were going to make with the world by sharing? Because I know that you're drawing from you sharing, let's say, your story with cancer, and that allowed a lot of other women that had similar struggles open up to you. And I know that was part of it, but can you kind of share with our audience, because of that, like, Dawn was born, and what was your vision for it?
So basically when I had cancer, diagnosed with cancer and treated for cancer, I was on my political journey. I had just got into politics. Mm. And spending nearly two decades in journalism, I realized that I was the only colored face within the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And I didn't see that until I actually stepped into politics, because in the political arena, again, it was predominantly males and white males. So I thought, wow, hang on. In our culturally diverse society, why is it that people of culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds aren't in leadership roles? Why don't we see more of them? You know, because I've always looked for somebody who looks similar like me or had a story like mine, so I can actually, it's a selfish thing, because I want to actually get them to give me advice or guide me or mentor me so that I can actually do better. But I looked around and there weren't any. So I thought, prior to me being diagnosed with cancer, I was focused very much about of getting more women in particular and more people of Asian heritage involved in politics. So I was going out there campaigning. And once I got cancer, I thought, oh God, I didn't have the energy to campaign. I didn't know whether I was going to live long either. So I thought, well, what can I do to ensure that the legacy will be there? So I then formed. So quite a few women, diverse Asian Australian women, got together with me and we said, let's do a women's sort of diverse Australasian women's network. It's actually what the Staunch stood for. So we were organizing events and having conversations around diversity and leadership. And so when we launched that, there were a lot of people that came. It wasn't just Asian women. There were men. There were diverse men, diverse women who came along and said, oh, my God, what you're doing is so important because we have experienced the barriers to climb up in that corporate or in a leadership role within organizations because we are people of different cultural backgrounds and English isn't our first language. So then the men then said to me, if you made it to women focus, you won't be able to champion for us. So then I dropped from that first 12 months, I dropped the word women and I thought, well, Dawn then stood for a new era of leadership, dawn of a new era of leadership. And so the focus then was to bring a new era of leadership through conversation. So I ran a lot of workshops through Dawn the first few years, going into corporates, going to government agencies, talking about the importance of diversity and cultural diversity in the workplace and the financial benefit. Because in business, there has to be a bottom line. They don't want to do soft things. Oh, yes, you know, I'm not going to do something for cultural diversity. I said, well, think about it in terms of policies. If you actually have a diverse team of leaders helping you shape a policy, that piece of policy, it's going to be have a greater outcome for a diverse society that we live in, right? So there are benefits in having that cultural diverse team. And so that's what I've been driving for the last 6 years is the importance of it, the bottom line, the economic benefit, and the financial benefit of having culturally diverse teams and asking organizations and asking leaders to think more inclusively because unfortunately our leaders are still predominantly white men. And so we're having these conversations to ask them to look at their leadership pipelines and think about how am I going to shift that leadership pipelines in the future time when I'm no longer there. How can I make sure that my team are quite diverse? So that is something that I still live and breathe for a world whereby we see more women, more diverse leaders in our mainstream institutions. I mean, the States, you have more diversity. You see it on your television screens. You know, you have African Americans, Black Americans, Hispanic Americans. Whereas in Australia, it's still not that diverse yet when you turn to our mainstream media institutions or when you turn to look at our parliamentary systems. Right. Whereas your Congress and your Senate is quite diverse. So you're ahead. But then the US has got the race policy, you know, the race issues. So therefore, race is constantly, you know, part of your how your community or how your country, you know, are able to talk about race more, even though there are tensions. Whereas over here, we don't talk about race. We, you know, it's kind of constantly swept under, and it's more of the British. We got the British heritage, the Westminster system, whereby it's very stiff upper lip, and you don't talk about it. But it's great. Through Dawn, I've been able to activate some of those conversations. I'm a strong advocate for that. But I don't come from a blame perspective. I come from a conversation and storytelling perspective, whereas asking questions, we're asking people to reflect on it and looking at the opportunities. So I don't come in from the blame. I say, you know, do something about it because... I just talk about, I'm comfortable for a very collaborative perspective, conversational, and the getting people the opportunity also to think and say, actually, why it's not happening, you know, because sometimes it's unconscious. They don't even do it consciously.
Right. And I think it's so beautiful because it's like, I just love how you say, you know, tell untold stories of unsung heroes. And I think there's really two parts to it. The first is like break that stigma. and let them like speak for themselves and share their stories and inspire, because that's how you're really going to make an actual revolution and change things up, is through inspiration. You can't force your way through. You gotta, you know, and I think that that's what Dawn is doing is so beautiful. But as we're wrapping up this conversation, like, there is a couple of things I want to touch base, and, you know, as short as long as you want to put it, the first one is, because I know you came from that journalism background and you used to tell stories for people, and now you inspire people to tell their own stories. I really want our audience to understand, like, what is the difference of it? You know what I mean? Like, how much more powerful is it to have them tell their own story than tell somebody else's story?
Yeah, so I used to go and interview people and then write their stories, right? And that comes from, I mean, look, there is a need for that, for sure.
Yeah.
So that you can kind of be kind of, you know, one's arm's length, so that you, if there's more credibility around that, you know, somebody reporting about you. But what I have found is that because through COVID, people are moving more online, and they're trying to tell their own story, but they do it in a way that is not authentic, because people don't, like, as you said, they don't tell their own story naturally, right? They hold back. So we've come up, you know, through the Dawn Media Productions, we thought, well, we want to help. I think it's more powerful to tell your story, but do it in such a way that you come across so natural and so authentic, right? So you don't sit there and say, oh, this is what I've done. And, you know, it's just the way that it's produced. What we're trying to do is to make sure that you telling your own story, it comes across easy. It comes across like, because imagine if you go around and try and find people constantly to interview, you won't have the time to do that. But if you encourage people to tell their own stories, they're more of that, right? It's easier for people to tell their own stories. And how to break that fear of telling one's own story is us facilitating, right? So we're still asking you questions. We're still facilitating and extracting that questions from you. So it looks like you are being interviewed, but it's coming from you. And therefore, when you send your stories out, because we've produced it for you, it comes really naturally and authentically. So, you know, we're encouraging people to tell it, because in the world with 7 billion, there's 7 billion stories, and, you know, one person going out there interviewing one, it's not going to be, you know, you're not going to get around to it. There are many media organizations doing that. But the problem with that is that you can spin it. So me as an interviewer, I can spin that, right? But so if you tell your own story, you know, you don't spin it. It's your story. It's coming from your mouth.
And I feel like there's that emotional connection too when you're hearing it. It's one thing to hear someone else tell somebody's story, but when you hear it from the source, like whatever they've gone through,
it's so authentic.
So I just really just want to wrap this up by just thanking you, Dai. I really want, just being so open. You have such a colored, like, just eventful, I would say that thing, eventful
past.
Eventful life. But that's like, I just want people to see Dai's story and really embrace their own stories, because like Dai is Dai today because of everything she's been through, everything she's experienced. That's why she can speak to so many people. That's why even this whole time of just listening to her story, I'm like, half the time I'm like, and my mouth is down, and I'm like, I don't know what to say next. But it's something, what I really want you, the audience, to understand is just embrace your story, the good and the bad, because a lot of the time that you have to go through the struggle, you have to make the mistakes in order for you to become the next best version of yourself. And I'll be the first to admit, I've made tons of mistakes, and you know what I mean? I'm still, and we're always on that path to trying to break out of it. But Dai, I just really want to say again, like, after hearing your story, I've been so inspired to be more vocal. And I hope that the audience would be more vocal about their own and use it to impact the people around you. There's always somebody out there that needs to hear your story. There's 7 billion people. At the end of the day, we are our worst enemy. You know what I mean? Like, once you put it yourself out there, you're not going to speak to everybody. Nobody can. But you will be speaking to a very specific individual that resonates with your story, and you'd be surprised what lives you can change with it.
Yeah. Impact the world with one courageous conversation at a time. So tell your story to impact the world. And I think you can help the world through sharing your stories and sharing it powerfully as well, right?
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Planet Film. Remember, you can achieve the life you've always wanted. Thank you so much for being a part of this community. And until next time, stay hungry.